As you know, it's important to me that the supplements I recommend and use are of the highest quality. That's why I stock the Protocol for Life Balance product line in my online dispensary, drhoffman.com/protocolforlifebalance. Protocol for Life Balance offers a wide range of professional-grade products using ingredients backed by strong scientific research, including a suite of supplements supporting your cardiovascular health, Clinical Cardio 6, Ubiquinol, and K2, MK7, and D3. This collection offers a powerful combination of targeted nutrients and botanicals that are known to promote optimal cardiovascular health by supporting healthy blood pressure, arterial flexibility, cellular energy production, neutralization of free radicals, protection against oxidative stress, and promotion of healthy vascular structures. For more information and to order, just go to drhoffman.com/protocolforlifebalance. That's drhoffman.com/protocolforlifebalance. Protocol for Life Balance is an A-rated GMP manufacturer of premium dietary supplements. Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Glad to have you aboard to explore some questions that listeners send to us. Questions come to questions@drhoffman.net. I'm very happy to see that you all are participating and sending great questions, but we need some more for the mailbag for next week. So if you have a question or an experience, you know, like some people reported on the results of taking certain supplements in part one, or if you have a medical quandary, some comments about our show, or even suggestions for things that we should take up on our programs, you can write to questions@drhoffman.net. And each week we open up our mailbox and see what's there. So what's our next question?
Okay, this comes from Nasir. Dear Dr. Hoffman, I know you recommend olive oil, but recent research out of Italy indicates that high-quality olive oil, even the one in the glass bottles, has microplastics. Now, these are presumably acquired in the manufacturing process. Are you aware of this? Do you still recommend olive oil? What do we do?
Well, you know, I'm not aware of that per se, and if Nasir has the article, I'd be happy to review it. So if you could send us a link or a copy of the article, you know, you can just append a link to an email. Let's take it up.
Yeah, send it to questions@drhoffman.net.
Yeah, because the first thing I always like to do is view the actual source, see if it's a credible source, and look at the research. And, you know, because I think that it's fair to
the methodology.
Yeah. So I would say that there's no question that the quality of olive oil varies enormously. And there's a lot of outright corruption and deception in the olive oil business. And there's sometimes adulteration of olive oil, and where olive oil is combined with other less desirable oils because they're cheaper, and or olive oil that's labeled extra virgin oil is actually, you know, processed, not cold processed, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Olive oil that says it's from Italy, you know, is from other parts of the world, which may be
other parts of the world, and it comes into one central location, and they,
in
Italy, it comes through.
Exactly. It reminds me of, you know, it's like the fashion industry in Italy. It could just as well be made in China because they just import Chinese labor there in sweatshops in Italy, and then they sell this ultra luxurious goods that are essentially could have been made in China. But they can say made in Italy, and that's why Italy got socked with COVID-19. First country in the world outside of China that just got slammed with COVID-19 because of the very, very brisk commerce between, you know, going back and forth, workers coming to and fro from China. All right, a little aside. So that's a concern. That's a concern, you know, and you want to source it the best possible way. One of our sponsors, not currently, but, you know, intermittently, because they kind of, they come on, they go off, they come on, they go off. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. I'm currently a subscriber. I get my olive oil from them. They're very ethical. They can be a little pricey, but there is just delicious olive oil. I think they're very ethical about, you know, how they source it and how they process it. And it's worth it. Now, where would the microparticles get into it? I mean, is there something inherent about the processing where they put it in, use some machinery with plastic parts, or whether there's some plastic containers that they use, temporarily before they put it into glass bottles? I don't know. I don't know how that happens. But, as a brief aside, what are microparticles? Maybe, you can sally forth, because nanoplastics, microplastics. Mm-hmm. What's that all about?
Yeah. It is ubiquitous in the environment. So I can imagine that it's hard to stay away from it at all. If anything, aside from growing your own olives and pressing yourself, well, as we get more into regenerative farming and doing more local, who knows? That may be the wave of the future. But for now, I think the best way to deal with the toxins in our environment, after we've controlled the controllables and gotten the best quality and organic and all of that, is to keep our livers clean. Make sure that you're detoxing well.
Mm-hmm. The concern about microparticles is that they're not actually the chemicals. Because, chemical toxicity, we can excrete, we can sweat it out in a sauna or something, but microparticles they're just so tiny, but they're forever particles, and they have the ability to infiltrate every organ of our body, and they've actually been found in cadavers in their brains. And so this is really a concern. We don't know their full impact, but it ain't good. So, for example, in atherosclerosis, the higher the level of microparticles, the greater the level of atherosclerotic plaque. There's something particularly irritating to human cells and human organs about these really tiny particles. And plastics, you see it at the seashore sometimes. Sometimes little particles of plastic, or even in fish, you see the, in their internal organs and in their gills, there's these little pieces of plastic. But even worse are the kind that are microscopic. You can't even see them, and you can actually inhale them. They're so small that they float in the air. And so the only way that we're going to be able to cope with that is to get away from plastics. And you just go, come on, how are we going to get... Yeah. We've just kind of come up with, through our ingenuity, reduce our dependency on plastics, because we've already polluted the planet with enough plastic to last millennia, and we just kept to stop adding it. Recycling isn't the answer, because recycling is just putting some, it's greenwashing.
It is. 10% is recycled. Yeah. That's about it.
It's a hype. It just puts a sheen of virtue on the industry that, we're recycling now, and, the products that you have now are like recycled plastic. Oh, right. But 90% of it or more is de novo plastic created from petroleum. We're just adding to the Earth's burden.
We have to stop consuming it.
Yeah.
We have to stop consuming it. We have to stop buying those plastic containers. Yes, they're convenient. We have to stop using the products. You have to stop going to the salad bar, using the plastic container, the plastic, all of it, foods that you're using that are lined in plastic. You have to reconsider your consumption.
Yeah,
and
but
if
it,
we
you see,
all do this.
It, yeah. It, yeah, but I think it should not be a matter of personal responsibility, because I got to tell you that that's limited. First, a lot of people aren't conscientious. I'm as conscientious as I can be, but I got to tell you that every couple of days, I empty a full waste basket full of plastic recyclables into the recycling bin. And if I looked at the amount of plastic that I've consumed in my lifetime, it would be a mountain for me personally, as one individual on the planet. And it's got to happen through some sort of worldwide governmental initiative. And everybody wants to have their, whatever, their convenient containers and that. We've got to change the direction.
Absolutely. There have to be alternative products that can take the place. I keep coming back to IV bags, Dr. Hoffman, because back in the 40s and 50s, they were IV glass or something, bottles,
but expensive, hazardous, you know, because they would, the IV poles would fall down and they would break, you know, and they'd shatter. So convenience, you know, the disposable bags, blah, blah, blah. And also all this disposable equipment, because once you, you know, have used it, you got to use it to throw away because it's not reusable. Problem for the planet.
Yeah. Lots of things to consider. Nasir, thank you for bringing this to our attention. If you do have that research, if you could email us a link to questions@drhoffman.net, greatly appreciated so we can take a look at it, maybe explore further.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We've got an email here from Don. Good day. I recently had a discussion.
Oh, wait a minute. Is he from Australia? Good day. Good day.
From Don. No. Good day. Maybe. I recently had a discussion with my dietitian regarding my protein intake and muscle loss. And the information that I've been working with for years is that vegetable protein, for the most part, is incomplete protein and therefore lacking in the 9 essential amino acids. Well, my dietitian pointed out that this is old information, and new insights in science show that as long as one is eating a broad range of plant protein, there is no such thing as a lack of essential protein.
Right.
In other words, the amino acids that might be lacking in one vegetable, you know, we learn about this in undergrad nutrition, even Dr. Hoffman. I remember the days in class of, because one is lacking in tryptophan and the other is lacking in lysine, you put the rice and the beans together. Yep. Well, and you get all of your protein.
So just an aside here, this actually, this notion of protein combining dates back to a lady who I first read about when I got interested in nutrition in the 1960s and 70s. Well, probably more the 70s, because in the 60s I was into meatball sandwiches and pizza. But it so in this in the Frances Moore LaPay, L-A-P-P-E with an accent, on the E, wrote a book called Diet for a Small Planet. And you may recall it because it's a classic. And what it basically said, it was kind of an entree into the world of vegetarianism, because it said that, yes, it's true that while eggs, for example, are complete protein and dairy products are relatively complete and, you know, meat and especially organ meat is very complete in all the essential amino acids. Plants are not that complete, but various cultures have come up with food combining. So, you know, in you look at all the cultures in, you know, the Middle East, it's, I guess, you know, wheat and chickpeas, say, all right, that's popular, like bulgur wheat and chickpeas, and that together, bulgur the wheat, protein in the wheat is deficient, and the protein in the chickpeas a little deficient, but together they complement one another. They're complementary, the amino acid profiles. And then, you know, the Latin America, it's rice and beans, et cetera, et cetera. You know, then every culture has, you know, kind of naturally come up with something. So the problem, and then, but then there's soy. And soy is said to be, is said by some to be a complete protein. It's not.
Yes.
It's actually not because it is particularly skimpy in some of the branch chain amino acids. And especially low in leucine. But a lot of soy products are fortified with leucine. So then that makes it more of a complete protein. So it can be called a complete protein. I recently shared with listeners at a, on my radio show, a study which compared the completeness of soy protein versus a beef burger, the same size, like a quarter pounder versus a quarter pounder, a quarter pound soy burger versus a quarter pound wheat, a beef burger, for muscle repletion and muscle metabolism. In other words, they looked at where the rubber meets the road in terms of actual what this guy is concerned about. He's concerned about sarcopenia, the age-related loss of muscle mass. And what they found was that it took two soy burgers to equal one beef burger. So you'd have to have two quarter pounders to one beef burger. So the efficiency of the soy, you can overcome it by eating more. But as you point out, what's the consequence of eating more of those foods? You get more.
You're eating more carbohydrates.
Yes.
How much can you eat?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that has metabolic impacts.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So the accompaniment of the protein is usually a fair amount of starch.
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. Don has another question. Also, you know, how much protein do I actually require if I'm eating, you know, lentils, which are incomplete, but then I eat some yogurt? Yogurt, because it's animal protein, is pretty much a complete protein. But Don, here's what you do. You take your weight and you turn it into kilograms, and it's, you're basically talking, I'm at least 1 gram of protein per kilogram.
Okay.
Is where I would
stop. I like that.
And that would be a good way to go. And you're talking high biological value protein for the most part. A lot of people achieve that with, you know, 4 to 6 portions of protein per at least 2 of the meals during their day. That helps. And to do some weight-bearing exercise, some resistance training. Yeah. Very, very beneficial.
Right, because I think just cramming protein without the resistance training is shown to be minimally effective.
Yeah.
You can't just push it into your muscles. You have to actually do some resistance training to get that metabolic boost to your muscles. You know, I just question that nutritionist. You know, I just want... Yeah. I would like to know more about the nutritionist, what her personal values and food choices are, because it sounds like she's kind of a plant-based nutritionist. And this is part of the problem with going to a nutritionist. Their bias will...
They will insert their bias, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you have to be careful of that. Look, and let me give you an extreme example. I know in at least one of my undergrad nutrition classes, there were 2 or 3 people with eating disorders.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's a field that attracts, the old saw is that, you know, psychiatrists are crazy or psychologists are crazy. I mean,
right.
Not necessarily, but, you know, sometimes people who need to, you know, really want to work on their, shall we say, their mental, health gravitate towards those fields. And consequently, some people who are a little obsessed with nutrition gravitate towards nutrition, but they're obsessed in a way that is a little pathological, potentially.
Yeah. Yeah. So, Don, there you go. You want to eat more high biological value protein, better for your muscles, better for your bones going forward. Add resistance training. We can't all eat beans and rice. We're not all metabolically equipped to be doing that on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there you go. Thank you for that very thoughtful question, Don. I think now is a good time.
I was going to say, you read my mind.
Yeah.
Okay. So at this point, let's allow one of our sponsors to share an important message with you. So here goes.
You know how important it is to ensure that your supplements are genuine, safe, and effective. That's why I partnered with Fullscript, an online dispensing platform that only offers curated professional-grade brands I know and trust, the very same supplements that I prescribe to my patients and take myself. Never counterfeit or expired, always stored and shipped correctly. Just go to DearHoffmanStore.com to start your free Fullscript account. Buying through Fullscript offers fast shipping, optional refill reminders, a mobile-friendly site. It's safe, secure, and HIPAA-compliant and offers world-class support. Fullscript also gives you access to my custom-targeted supplement protocols that combine the products that I recommend to address specific needs, heart health, immune support, and much more. Just go to DearHoffmanStore.com to sign up for your free Fullscript account. You'll get access to the supplements and features you need to help you achieve your wellness goals. That's DearHoffmanStore.com. DearHoffmanStore.com.
Thanks for listening and thanks for supporting our sponsors. They, of course, are what make Intelligent Medicine a continuing free resource to you. And we are very careful in terms of vetting our sponsors. We're selective and we want our
messaging about their products to be informative for you and to be added value to these podcasts. So we appreciate you listening.
Yes. We've got an email from Gene. Gene sent us an article, a top government scientist engaged in research misconduct. And Gene is saying, what's wrong with the NIH? First Fauci and now this guy. Who would believe anything from the NIH? I hope RFK and Elon Musk look into what's happening to all of our money that's being given to the NIH. And apparently, the National Institutes of Health investigation found research misconduct by one of its top neuroscientists.
Yeah, there's several problems. One is outright fraud. And there has been a kind of a dismal series of revelations about research fraud in Alzheimer's disease, where this or that or the other approach to Alzheimer's disease that appeared to be a breakthrough was faked, or where, you know, the pictures were doctored, or that the research was not reproducible. And a lot of these papers have had to be retracted. So there's actually quite a robust scientific discipline of reviewing papers and debunking them, and then ultimately getting them retracted. There are actually various sleuths who sometimes look at research and they go, you know, that's a little fishy. That can't be, you know, it just doesn't add up. Then when they actually drill down and look at the data is contradictory, or the data seems to be fudged, you know, like, how can it be that every number is the same, you know, for like a sample, you know, like it's got to be made up, or that, you know, it doesn't, like, the numbers don't add up to 100 or something, like something basic like that. So there is a lot of that going on. There is also a trend towards trendy research. So that, you know, there's this process of grantsmanship, is to obtain a grant. You got to write something that is currently, you know, in vogue, right? And a lot of the studies that are being done are studies that try to show inequities and that are sort of in line with the view that, you know, women are being discriminated against, or certain groups are being discriminated against. And then the research is shoddy. It's not really, but it's appealing because it kind of answers an ideological narrative, you know. So there's that, I think they're going to try and go after, because, you know, that may have seen its day already, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Also, some of the climate-related research are done by climate scientists. Well, you know, usually idealistic young people gravitate towards climate science because they want to save the planet, right? Okay. Yeah. In nutrition research, similarly, there's research that shows that, you know, like a vegetarian diet is much healthier for you. And that it also is better for the planet.
And the planet,
yeah. Because, you know, we can't have all these cows, you know, emitting methane and, you know, accelerating climate, you know, like the kind of thing. That is, you know, it's kind of like pick your narrative and then backtrack to amass the scientific facts that support it, you know, and it's just like
right. And then get busy writing the grant proposal.
Yeah. And certain, you know, government agencies, bureaucrats are receptive. They're the gatekeepers. The medical journals also are kind of the gatekeepers for some of this research. I've noticed, for example, a lot of people are complaining about Scientific American, which is, you know, it's a journal where wonky lay people and scientists read fascinating articles about breakthroughs, you know, like in astronomy or in molecular biology or physics, you know, the great articles on cosmology, you know, the Big Bang theory, blah, 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 you know, that kind of stuff. But there's more and more articles about how, I mean, there was one article recently about how women really can be as physically strong as men. And and in some respects, there is some evidence that in certain activities, women have maybe more endurance or they have a higher pain threshold. But what they do is they try to amass evidence towards an ideological goal, which is, you know, equality of the sexes. And, you know, I mean, maybe buttressing an argument that, you know, we should have mixed sports more or something like that, or that, you know, more women in the armed forces or the uniformed forces, you know, that kind of an ideological bent rather than looking at hard science on that. So, yeah, I mean, this is a problem. And
it is.
I think we need to get back to a more objective science, you know, science that's practical and applicable generally picks up a bias one way or another. You know, you're carrying a torch for one thing or for another. And
And
in nutrition research, very prone to that. Nutrition research, very prone to that.
Yeah. And as the scientist with the most integrity is the one who comes up with a hypothesis and then spends the rest of their career trying to debunk it.
Well, this is actually...
We can't be biased towards our own hypothesis or our own answer. Because,
Yeah, I mean, that's actually the basis for every study is you come into it with a null hypothesis. In other words... and you're kind of like trying to overthrow the null hypothesis, which is that this association is meaningless. This thing doesn't work.
It has no effect.
So that actually should be the preordained conclusion, and that you have to, the burden of proof is to overthrow the null hypothesis.
Yes. That's it. Okay. Gene.
You generated an interesting discussion.
It's great. And we're going to see what happens when we, God willing, make America healthy again.
Yeah, I just want to introduce one other thing. Is there's also, of course, there's a lot of this with drugs, you know, that they, you know, hype the benefits and conceal the downsides. Some people say similarly with vaccines. There's also sometimes like national biases, you know, like studies which promote something from a country, you know, like a study from Cuba that says that polycosanol from sugar cane is the bomb for lowering cholesterol. Well, they got some great studies out of Cuba, which has kind of, I would say, kind of an authoritarian government.
Crop of sugar.
Right. And a lot of economic incentive to have a, like a cash crop. Right. But then when they try to do the same research in Scandinavia using the identical materials, it didn't pan out. So, you know, you'll see like chocolate studies coming out of Switzerland. You'll see like tofu studies coming out of Japan or natto studies coming out of Japan, you know, that kind of stuff.
Exactly. So bias does creep in. It's unfortunate. But, you know, this kind of misconduct needs to be identified and rectified and, you know. When I was an undergrad, I remember my professors telling us that, you know, NIH was the cleanest money, cleanest grant money, but that is no longer the case. No. And that was over 20 years ago. So here we are.
Yeah, I mean, by the way, I just want to say that there is a big article in Nature, which is one of the preeminent scientific journals, which was an endorsement for Kamala Harris, saying that Trump would be a big threat to science. And the headline was, scientists all over the world warn us of the threat of a Trump presidency. And, you know, I mean, maybe, you know, he's going to negatively impact the field of science, but really there is cause to, you know, look for some form of reform like, RFK is contemplating for the scientific establishment, you know, because he criticizes them for bias and for trying to throttle down what they term disinformation.
So we shall see going forward.
Yeah.
All right. Gene, thank you for that very important article. Thank you for sending us the link to that so we could take a look at it. Okay. We've got a question here from Joan. Hi, Dr. Hoffman. I'm 74 years old and my hair is getting thinner. Do you have any suggestions?
Hair does get thinner as you get older.
That's true.
And it
Lack
is,
of hormones.
I do not subscribe to the Miracle-Grow theory of hair. You know, like the thing that you put on your plants and your plants are luxuriant because, and sometimes it works. Sometimes
right.
it does. Miracle-Grow sometimes works. But a lot of the time, the problem is that, you know, it's not about whether the plant has enough nutrients. It's about the sunlight. It's about the age of the plant. It's about, you know, many, many other factors. You're putting too much water, not enough water. And so when it comes to hair, nutrition can play a role, maybe a 10% role, but it's often programmed hair loss or hair thinning that occurs with aging, you know, just as all the organs of the body become senescent. And that includes, you know, even our, you know, our blood cells and our white blood cells that determine our immunity. So what can you do? Well, there are various hair remedies, you know, that can promote hair growth, things like minoxidil. What are some of the things that you have clients who are concerned about their hair? What do you recommend? I mean, generally biotin,
biotin, maybe collagen.
Let's mention collagen.
I want to make sure there are no deficiencies.
Right.
I want to make sure they don't have a high folate
active thyroid. Yeah.
There are lots of, I want
iron
to make
deficiency.
Sure they're not low in iron.
Yes.
Their ferritin is at least a 90.
Yeah.
As opposed to just, you know, you want ferritin up there closer to 100.
Yep.
I want to make sure that they're not under some kind of stress or duress that could spike their cortisol. Mm-hmm. And that could certainly cause their hair thinning.
Mm-hmm.
If they were recently ill or had a surgery or there was some recent weight loss, hey, that'll cause your hair to... Anybody...
Lack of protein.
Losing weight.
Lack of protein.
Yes, anybody losing weight is going to lose some hair.
Mm-hmm.
That hair should come back.
Yep. Yep.
But
yeah, it's a shock to the body when you lose weight, and even in the most wholesome way. And the hair is a protein, and so the body kind of tries to conserve its resources, and it may cause less hair growth during a time of perceived famine. Protein is really important for hair because hair is proteinaceous. Certain of the amino acids are, you know, more associated with hair, you know, like, you know, proline and, you know, sulfur-containing amino acids. Like when you burn hair, you know, inadvertently, you know, you put your, you know, if you got a hairy hand, you put your hand over the fire, you know, over the burner, you'll smell like a sulfur smell. That's because hair contains sulfur amino acids. But it's not always just nutrition. And, you know, like you say, it could be a sign of a metabolic disorder, like hypothyroidism, and that needs to be checked out. You know, there are what are called trichologists. That's a subspecialty of dermatology, and they can do an evaluation. I think integrative doctors do a pretty good job of figuring out whether there are deficiencies associated with hair thinning. But hey, well, it's par for the course. 74, we're going to have thinning.
But you know, Another thing, Dr. Hoffman, maybe any prescription medications, certain medications cause hair thinning.
Yep.
Steroid medications can cause that, for example.
Yep.
So these are all things to look at.
Yeah, and also consider essential fatty acids, because I think they're really great for hair.
Absolutely.
So you know, things like your fish oil, EPA, DHA. Also consider GLA, because GLA has really some good skin effects, which might have ramifications for hair.
Yes.
From borage oil.
Yeah.
Or
evening from rose. Mm-hmm. Sure. Those are very good sources of that. So, okay. Joan, thank you for your question.
You know,
and I want to remind everyone.
I just want to say there's one other, there's like caffeine for hair, you know, caffeine applications for hair. That's kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. Sometimes people use helmets that have like, you know, like some kind of light therapy for hair. I'm not, you know, so sure
That's
about that. But there's, I guess there's a little bit of science, you know, it's kind of, you know, single digit to low double digit improvements in hair quality with stimulation of the hair follicles by these light helmets. They tend to be expensive. Caffeine shampoos along with minoxidil and things, you know.
Wow.
So go to a trichologist, they can sell you the right concoctions to optimize your hair, you know. But you can also get minoxidil, I think, over the counter these days.
Yes, true. You'll find that at your local CVS.
I just want to mention, just one other, you're about to close, but there's evidence, you know, minoxidil, you don't want to take oral minoxidil at the doses that it was originally intended for hypertension. This, how it was discovered, was that it was a drug used for hypertension, but it caused people to become like, you know, hairy werewolves. You know, it just caused hair to grow all over their body. Was obviously an undesirable side effect. So they said, well, we can't use this for blood pressure. Yeah, it can lower blood pressure, but no good. And then they decided, we'll use it for topical. It turns out that a very low dose of minoxidil that is not enough to impact blood pressure can be helpful for hair growth. Taking it internally, but a very low dose, like a half of a milligram daily or milligram, much lower than the dose required for blood pressure. But an interesting side effect of that is that people are fine with it, doesn't lower their blood pressure. But some people report that when they go on a plane, you know, they get off at their destination, they can't put their shoes on because it actually may, for some reason, cause some water retention, swelling.
Yeah. Interesting.
It's weird. So that's pretty much a rundown of some of the things that you can look to. I guess I'm kind of complacent about it because I still have a pretty good head of hair.
You do. Yeah, it's great. Yeah.
So I don't know if that's
take that for granted. So many people are plagued with hair thinning.
It's partially a merit system, but I also like it as a family tendency to retain hair, on the male side for quite some time. My father was bald, but it's the maternal side, and my mother's brother had a full head of hair, unfortunately died of a massive heart attack at about 70. So, So the hair didn't help him on the longevity front, but he looked good.
A reminder to all of our listeners that you can email questions, Q&A with Layla, questions at drhoffman.net. That's questions@drhoffman.net. And you can call a phone number to record your question for the Intelligent Medicine Radio Show anytime, 24/7.
Yeah, please do. Please do that. Yeah.
And that number is 877-726-8255.
Yeah, if you prefer to pose your question that way, we'll air that question on my radio show that's heard on the weekends. And you can be part of that show as well. Lots of ways to get through to us. Thank you, Layla, for joining us, and have a great week, everybody.
Thank you, Dr.
Hall. We have podcasts every day of the week. They drop on a daily basis, so subscribe to our podcasts. Follow us on social media. We're on X. We're on Facebook. And thereby you can become a more informed listener to Intelligent Medicine. Take advantage of all aspects of it, and also subscribe to our newsletter via the website.
Okay. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I want to thank you for listening to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or your favorite podcast app, and get new episodes automatically downloaded every weekday. And please give us a rating and review. It truly helps new people discover Intelligent Medicine. The Intelligent Medicine Podcast is for general informational purposes only and does not constitute the practice of medicine, nursing, or other professional healthcare services, including the giving of medical advice, and no doctor-patient relationship is formed. The use of information on this podcast or materials linked from this podcast is at the user's own risk. The content of this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Users should not disregard or delay in obtaining medical advice for any medical condition they may have, and should seek the assistance of their healthcare professionals for any such conditions. Finally, please visit drhoffman.com and discover everything Intelligent Medicine has to offer, including frequently updated, unbiased health news and fully vetted product and supplement recommendations.
This is Layla Mudin, registered dietitian nutritionist. I maintain a private practice and see patients regularly. If you require a nutrition consult with me but live out of town, there's no need to travel to New York City. I have telephone and telehealth consultations with clients from all over the country. Please visit drhoffman.com for more information. And to set up an appointment, call 212-779-1744. That's 212-779-1744. I look forward to being a collaborator in your healthcare.